Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with an analysis of Saturday's talks between the P5+1 and Iran in Istanbul that might avert another war in the Middle East, since President Obama has warned that the window for diplomacy is closing. Colin Carl, who was Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for the Middle East at the Pentagon from 2009 to 2011, joins us to discuss a possible deal as the clock ticks on an Israeli strike against Iran's nuclear facilities. Then we will look ahead to the coming world with multiple centers of power and no global hegemon. Charles Kupchan, a former head of European affairs on the National Security Council, joins us to discuss his new book, No One's World, The West, The Rising East, and The Coming Global Turn, which makes the case we are entering a world of conflicting values and multiple paths to prosperity that not many Western policymakers and pundits want to contemplate, let alone prepare for. Then finally, on Tax Day, we will speak with the nation's leading expert on taxes and who pays them, David K. Johnston. A Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative reporter, he is a columnist for Reuters, where he has an article, Taxed by the Boss, a shocking expose that reveals how more than 2,700 of the biggest corporations like GE, GM, Goldman Sachs, and Procter & Gamble are collecting state income taxes from hundreds of thousands of workers and pocketing them with the state's approval. Joining us now is Colin Carl, who's a professor in the Security Studies program at the Edmund A. Walsh School of Foreign Service at Georgetown University. From February 2009 to December 2011, he was a Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for the Middle East at the Pentagon. In that capacity, he served as a senior policy advisor to the Secretary of Defense for Egypt, Iran, Iraq, Israel, and the Palestinian territories, Saudi Arabia, Syria, Yemen, and six other countries in the Levant and the Persian Gulf. Colin Carl is the author of State Scarcity and Civil Strife in the Developing World and is a regular consultant to the Department of Defense and the intelligence community. Welcome to Background Briefing, Colin Carl.
Thanks for having me.
And the P5 plus one, the permanent five on the UN Security Council plus Germany, their meeting took place in Istanbul on Saturday with the Iranians, led by their national security advisor, Saeed Jalili, who apparently is very close to the supreme leader. Apparently, according to the European representative, Ms. Ashton, everything went very well. However, one thing that puzzled me is that apparently the United States tried to get the Iranian delegation to meet separately, and that was turned down by the Iranians. In other words, the U.S. wanted to hold some bilateral talks on the side with the Iranians, and they rejected that. What's your understanding of that?
Yeah, I don't think we have the full details. The Iranians did meet in a couple of bilaterals. They had a bilateral with the EU representative, Catherine Ashton, Lady Ashton, who you mentioned a minute ago. They also held bilaterals with China and Russia. The U.S. representative, Undersecretary Wendy Sherman, had noted that she was willing to meet with any of the parties there to discuss the agenda items. But we have conflicting reports as to whether a formal ask was made of the Iranians and whether they turned it down. I don't know that we should make too much of that. I think at some point everybody understands that serious bilateral conversations will have to happen between the United States and Iran to resolve this issue. But at this stage, I think U.S. negotiators are also sensitive to the point that there's a lot of domestic controversy associated with kind of jumping into the deep end of the pool on bilateral negotiations with the Americans too early in the process.
So what do you make then, Colin Carl, of the talks being held now in May the 23rd in Baghdad? Apparently the Iranians also suggested Beirut and Damascus, clearly locations over which they have influence. And I don't think anybody's ever going to show up in Damascus. But we've got, 6 weeks here? Is that a case of kicking the can down the road? Given the urgency of the talks and President Obama framing these talks as warning that the window for diplomacy is closing?
Yeah, I actually think there were several good signs that came out of the talks. First, Iran was willing to seriously discuss their nuclear program, which they had not been in the previous talks 15 months ago in Istanbul, where they were basically wanted to talk about everything but their nuclear program. There was a high degree of unity among the P5+1 countries. One of Iran's tactics historically has been to try to divide the international community, but the international community was united in this case. Third, they did set a date for a follow-on meeting in Baghdad on May 23rd, and they agreed to hold interim technical discussions to make sure that meeting was more productive. I think the Iranian representatives at the meeting signaled a desire to delay the EU oil sanctions, and what I take from that is that they're worried about the economic effect of sanctions, so that indicates there might be some leverage over them. But at the same time, Iranian representatives framed the talks as representing a spirit of cooperation, and they reiterated the Supreme Leader's fatwa or religious edict against the use or possession of nuclear weapons. And I think they did all of that in order to frame the issue in a way that, a possible compromise down the road could be sold domestically. So I kind of see all of these things as not just mere atmospherics, not just talk about more talk, but actually building up to something. But as you mentioned, what that something will be, we don't know yet. And the Obama administration's been pretty clear that they are open to diplomacy, but diplomacy won't be open-ended.
And Colin Carr, what do you make then of, obviously, there's no unanimity amongst the P5 plus one. However, Russia started off the talks, apparently, and the Iranians thanked the Russians, and the Russian delegate bluntly said, Russia doesn't have to be thanked. We need you to do what we need you to do. What explains the fact that the Russians, who have good relations with Iran, and the Chinese, who have enormous trading ties, not the least of which is they're one of the main customers for Iranian oil, what explains their apparent annoyance with Iran?
Well, I think because Iran has gone for more than a year with being basically unresponsive to diplomatic outreach. The Russians have been trying to get them to be serious about what they call their step-by-step approach. That the Chinese, for their part, are very much worried not only about energy sanctions that have been put in place by the United States, by the Europeans and others, but also about the prospect of a war in the Middle East triggered by an Israeli strike sometime in the next few months. So I think the patience level on both the Russian side and the Chinese side is pretty low at the moment, which is why I think actually the P5 plus one was a little bit more unified than is sometimes the case. I think the true test, however, will be, you know, when they meet in Baghdad and concrete proposals are actually put on the table, you know, how much agreement there is among the P5 plus one countries. And so I think one of the challenges between now and then will be for the representatives of the P5 plus one to try to create as a united a position on going into those negotiations as possible.
Well, I guess on the surface, one can make the assumption, Colin Carr, that there's at least 6 weeks have been bought in terms of delaying any possible strike.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's right. I think that I think the Iranians clearly don't have an interest in Israel striking. The P5 plus one countries don't have an interest in Israel striking. And I think that your intuition is right, that it will be more difficult for the Israelis to strike as negotiations go on. But I'll tell you, that only will probably last for so long. I mean, the talks at some point have to bear fruit, or the Israelis will declare the talks a failure, and they'll move on to other options. So I think everybody is cognizant that nobody's looking to just run out the clock on the Israelis here. I think the Americans, for sure, are interested in trying to get a concrete set of compromises in the near term that will help address some of those core issues, such as 20% enrichment and the installation of centrifuges at the Fordo enrichment facility in the mountain near Qom, that are really driving Israeli anxieties and American anxieties, frankly. So I think unless there's concrete progress in the next several weeks, you know, the talking is not going to hold the Israelis off for very long.
Again, I'm speaking with Colin Carr. He's a professor in the Security Studies program at the Edmund A. Walsh School of Foreign Service at Georgetown University. From February 2009 to December 2011, he was the Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for the Middle East at the Pentagon and is the author of States, Scarcity, and Civil Strife in the Developing World, and is a regular consultant to the Department of Defense and the intelligence community. Well, of course, I think these talks are happening, and the extent to which there's optimism as a result of Saturday's talks between the P5 plus one and Iran probably are the result of these sanctions. And they really start to kick in, I understand, in a few months' time. France, curiously enough, when I mentioned earlier, Colin Carr, that there's no unanimity amongst the P5 plus one, France is to the right of the U.S. on this, almost taking the position of the Israelis. So the long and the short of it is, though, I think, isn't it the point is when the Asian customers stopped buying Iranian oil, they're going to have to shift their refineries over to a different formula because of the nature of Iranian oil. That's an expensive process. And once they do that, it's less likely that they'll turn back. So I take it that there's some serious leverage that these sanctions are developing.
No, I mean, I think there's tremendous and increasing leverage. I mean, even last December, we were hearing noises out of the Iranians about how these sanctions were the worst sanctions they've ever experienced. And that was before the U.S. went forward with its Central Bank of Iran sanctions, which could effectively cut off a large number of Iran's potential energy customers from the U.S. banking system if they don't curtail purchases of Iranian oil. That's already led to a decline in purchases among some. And then the EU, the European Union, followed up with a decision to put in place an oil embargo. Now both of those don't fully kick in until the end of June and into July. So we have this moment, I think, of significant leverage. And I think evidence for that is the fact that Jalili apparently, at the negotiations in Istanbul, asked Ashton for the sanctions to be lifted or to be delayed. Ashton was noncommittal on that and basically said, any talk of that was premature and would have to be in response to concrete steps to address the international community's objections to the way Iran is conducting its nuclear activities. So I do think there's considerable leverage. I do think the Iranians are worried about it, and the task for our diplomats between now and the Baghdad talks is to figure out how to use that leverage.
But there is something that I've never understood in terms of a kind of disconnect here. Iran is under four sets of UN sanctions for refusing to stop uranium enrichment. They say they need to go to 20% to get medical isotopes for 150,000 Iranians suffering from cancer, I imagine. To solve that problem is relatively easy, to provide small amounts of uranium for these production of medical isotopes. And the fact that they've moved their centrifuges to this underground, somewhat impregnable facility they built at Fordo, which they didn't declare until it was found, that has led, I guess, to a lot of skepticism. So the reasons that they need to enrich to 20%, and they have a sovereign right to do so, they are signatories to the NPT. I imagine during these talks they brought up the fact that the Israelis aren't and that they have a mature nuclear arsenal. But the long and the short of it is the Iranian position's never made any sense in terms of the pain that this alleged need for nuclear enrichment is inflicted upon the country. And the fact that it could be easily solved leads one to be suspicious of what they're up to.
I think you're absolutely right. I mean, it only makes sense in a world in which the Iranians are engaged in what nuclear proliferation experts call a nuclear hedging strategy. That is, they're doing all sorts of activities ostensibly under the cover of civilian purposes. So enriching to 3.5% for nuclear reactors that they don't have or that are already fueled by Russian fuel, and enriching up to 20% for a research reactor, the Tehran research reactor, when they could get that fuel from outside and have already been offered that fuel from outside. The reason they're doing all these things, though, is to perfect the fuel cycle, and proliferation analysts think, in order to put themselves into a position to eventually be able to make the decision to weaponize their nuclear program if they decided to do so. So the reason most Iran analysts think that they're willing to endure all this pain is that they want to get as close to the line of a nuclear weapons breakout capability as they can, because frankly, having a virtual or an actual nuclear weapons arsenal would be seen by the regime as highly advantageous. So I think that's the only explanation for why they're willing to endure this much pain. That said, they're clearly worried about the pain, and the question will be in the next couple months whether that pain is sufficient to get them to start to scale back their program and start to meet more of their international obligations.
And I understand, Colin Kyle, that from the intelligence community, there's widespread belief that the Iranians actually have Chinese nuclear devices, blueprints, whatever, that they got from AQ Khan. So, you know, technically it wouldn't be that difficult for them to move ahead once they get the nuclear fuel.
Well, the intelligence community, in terms of their open testimony and some of the open source material, has been pretty consistent. Iran currently has enough low-enriched uranium to produce as many as four nuclear weapons, should they decide to do so. If they started to enrich their low-enriched uranium up to weapons-grade level, it would take them at least 4 months after diverting their stockpile and recalibrating their centrifuges. It would take them at least 4 months to create the fissile material, the weapons-grade material, for one bomb. But it would take a year total to transform all the research and development that they may have done into weaponization into an actual crude device. Now, this wouldn't be something they could put on the tip of a missile, that would take several more years. We're talking about a device they might be able to put in a ship or in a truck or something like that. So the intelligence community has been pretty consistent that from the point of a decision by Iran's supreme leader, it would take Iran a year to go for a bomb. But analysts have also been careful to point out they're highly unlikely to make that decision anytime soon, because to make that decision would require them to enrich to weapons grade at declared facilities at Natanz or Fordo, and therefore they'd get caught by the international community, and that would bring the house down on them, to include likely military action by the United States and others.
So why then is Israel pushing so hard, and through their supporters in the U.S. Congress? Senator Lieberman has got an amendment, which I think is going to be debated in the Senate this week, which is essentially would foreclose these very talks that are taking place. So why do that? Why, you know, why not allow diplomacy a chance? And what explains the very hawkish position from the Israelis?
Yeah, the Israelis actually don't have a fundamentally different understanding of the Iranian nuclear program than the U.S. intelligence community. The biggest difference is the fact that the Israelis have far fewer military capabilities than the United States. I mean, Israel is a potent military force, the most powerful military force in the Middle East, but they don't have the capability to set back the Iranian program in the way that the United States military does. And this facility that we've talked about, this Fordo enrichment plant, which was previously covert and then was outed by the Obama administration in the fall of 2009, is 200 or 300 feet underground in the side of a mountain. I mean, it's one of these kind of James Bond supervillain type of places. And the Israelis have been consistent that they don't have the conventional capability to destroy this facility. So as the Iranians have started to make that facility operational this year, Israeli leaders, principally Minister of Defense Ehud Barak, have really emphasized what he calls the risk that Iran will enter the so-called zone of immunity. That is, that across a certain threshold, it's not that Iran will suddenly have a bomb, it's that Iran's program, their program will be unreachable by Israeli bombs. That is, Israel won't be able to set the program back. So it creates kind of a now-or-never moment for the Israelis. If they don't strike Iran's program this year, they argue, it'll be much more difficult for them to set back the program in the future. And so the only possibility, if they don't strike this year, would be to rely on the United States and the international community to do it. And then there's a question about whether they, you know, have faith that the international community would actually do it if Israel doesn't.
Well, I've been reading some recent articles. There was an article in Foreign Policy suggesting that Israel has made some arrangements with Azerbaijan to land their planes after a strike, which would make it much more feasible because, you know, they'd be pushing their air force to the limits to enact an attack on Iran, which I think you've indicated wouldn't even work because they don't have the ability to get to this underground facility. But nevertheless, they've been pretty clear that, you know, there's been a lot of high-ranking intelligence people in Israel expressing concern. They may well have arrangements with the Iraqi Kurds as well. So would you agree that at this point, Israel at least has the idea that they wouldn't be able to pull this off technically is no longer applicable?
It completely depends on what you're talking about. There's two technical limitations. One is fuel, and if they potentially have places to bed down in Azerbaijan or somewhere in Iraq or somewhere, it could help them mitigate some of the fuel concerns, because otherwise they have to send, you know, almost 100 aircraft 1,000 miles and do some extraordinarily complex in-air refueling. It would be by far the most complex thing the Israeli Air Force has ever done. If they were able to land somewhere else, that may make it a little easier. But the other limitation is that they don't have the munitions, that is the sufficient size of bunker-busting bombs, to get into the Fordo facility. That's they've talked about that themselves. So even if you were able to mitigate some of the refueling problems, it doesn't actually make the Iranian sites necessarily more vulnerable to Israeli attack. You know, some people ask, then why shouldn't the United States provide Israel with the bunker busters to make sure that they can get into Iranian facilities? And the answer to that is Israel already has all the bunker busters in their inventory that their aircraft are capable of delivering. The one game-changing munition is the one developed by the U.S. Air Force called the Massive Ordnance Penetrator, which is a 30,000-pound beast of a bomb that can only be dropped by a B-2 stealth bomber. So the Israelis simply have no capability to drop something like that, even if we were to provide them one.
Well, just in closing, though, Colin Cowell, I don't understand, though, why or how this threat is actual leverage. As you know, this is an election year from the National Defense Authorization Act, which Senators McCain and Lieberman and Graham pushed. The president threatened to veto that because he felt that it tied his hands on Iran and would force the price of oil up. Any military strike would not only force the price of oil up, it would probably cause a global recession or depression even. It's a catastrophic red line. So I'm curious to know why I suppose in order to have the leverage that brings Iran to the table, you have to exercise the threat. But the threat itself is so catastrophic. It's almost takes you back to the days of mutually assured destruction with nuclear weapons.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know how seriously the Iranians take the threat. I think the Iranians probably aren't sure whether the Israelis will really do it. They may feel like at the end of the day, if the Americans don't support the Israelis doing it, the Israelis won't do it. But on the other hand, you have an Israeli prime minister who regularly refers to a nuclear-armed Iran as risking a second Holocaust and defining it in the most stark of existential terms, suggesting that Israel won't wait forever. And Israel doesn't have a history of letting its neighbors develop nuclear weapons. They have a history of striking those programs before they're developed. They hit the Iraqi program in 1981. They hit the Syrian program in 2007. So there's just nothing in Israeli history to suggest they would remain constrained. As it relates to the oil price issue, I suspect the Israelis believe that oil prices would go up by $20, $30, $40 a barrel for a couple of weeks, but then the conflict would settle down and the oil prices would settle back down and things would basically go back to normal. I'm not sure that that's right, but I do think they may believe it. As it relates to the Iranians, I don't know if the Iranians fear an Israeli strike, but they do have to be concerned that if Israel starts something, it could lead to a wider war that draws the Americans in, and that would be something that the Iranians would worry about very, very much. So the combination of sanctions and this kind of shadow of military conflict in the background, I do think provides some leverage on the Iranians, and now it'll be up to our diplomats to try to take advantage of that leverage.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, Colin Carl.
Thanks for having me.
Again, I've been speaking with Colin Carl, who's a professor in the Security Studies program at the Edmund A. Walsh School of Foreign Service at Georgetown University from February 2009 to December 2011. He was Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for the Middle East at the Pentagon, and he is the author of States, Scarcity, and Civil Strife in the Developing World, and is a regular consultant to the Department of Defense and the intelligence community. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking with the former head of the European desk of the National Security Council, Charles Kupchan, about his new book, No One's World.
One, two, three, four.
Ready to call, just like Humpty Dumpty. I'm going to fall, and I'm sitting on top of the world. I'm rolling along, yes, rolling along. Don't want any million, I'm getting my share. I've only got one suit, just one, that's all I can wear.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Charles Kupchan, a professor of international affairs at Georgetown University and a senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations. He was the director for European affairs on the National Security Council during the Clinton administration, and before that worked in the U.S. Department of State's policy planning staff. He is the author of How Enemies Became Friends, The End of the American Era, and his latest book is No One's World, The West, The Rising Rest, and The Coming Global Turn. Welcome to Background Briefing, Charles Kupchan.
Happy to join you again, Ian.
And your book makes the case we are entering a world of conflicting values and multiple paths to prosperity that not many Western policymakers and pundits want to contemplate, let alone prepare for. Yet our president and the presidential candidates, and now it's down to Mitt Romney, keep talking about American exceptionalism and the American century. President Obama in his State of the Union address said that anybody tells you that America is in decline doesn't know what they're talking about. How useful is that kind of rhetoric?
Well, I think that we're in an election season, and for obvious reasons, Romney and Obama and everyone else are going to be talking the talk of a new American century, particularly because I think Americans are spooked. They're spooked by the stagnant economy, by the political paralysis, by the rise of China, India, Brazil, and other countries, and I think politicians are attempting to calm their nerves. But I do think it is avoiding a national debate that we Americans must have, in the sense that we're at the beginning of a period in history in which the global distribution of power is changing. We're at a period in which confidence that all countries would be converging toward a Western brand of modernity, that's now up for grabs because state capitalism is doing well in China, political Islam is on the make in the Middle East. We need to discuss these issues. My guess is that's not going to happen until after November, and maybe not even then.
Well, it seems that Charles Kupchan, that we've always been somewhat insulated against the way the rest of the world sees us. And as you pointed out in a recent article in the New York Times, America's Place in the New World, that already the countries you just mentioned, India and Brazil, only vote with the U.S. at the United Nations 25% of the time.
Well, I think that there are a couple of different things going on here. One is that there are non-Western countries that are taking their seat at the table, like China, Russia, Vietnam, the sheikdoms of the Persian Gulf. They have styles of government and forms of government that are different than ours, and we therefore don't expect them to follow the leader, that is to say, to take the berth that the West has assigned them. But then we see countries like India and Brazil, and we say, they're democracies, they're secular liberal states. Clearly, they're going to side with us. But I think there's a false logic there, because in many instances, those emerging democracies are siding with other rising powers, whether democracies or not. And in that sense, I think we make an error in assuming that a country's domestic institutions will determine its geopolitical alignment, its place in the pecking order, its geographic location, its ideological proclivities. These will be at least as important as whether they are democratic or not.
But for some time, it seems, the state capitalist model has been operating before this recent emergence of China and others, Japan and South Korea. And, of course, Japan and Germany were, through the Marshall Plan in Europe, their economies were revived. I've always found it kind of curious why it is that we've gone on such a sort of a neoliberal path, and the rest of the world is not particularly picking up on it, except perhaps next door in Mexico, and yet, for example, in Germany, under the system that we implanted, if you will, all big German corporations, for example, have 50% of the board members are members of unions, and they have a completely different relationship. And we know how successful the Japanese have been over the years, and how successful the Koreans are with the universal broadband penetration, etc. So don't you think that perhaps not only is the rest of the world not following our path, that maybe we here in the United States might want to look back at what makes these other countries successful and competitive?
Well, that's why I think we're heading towards no one's world. And by that, I mean no particular model or no particular region will dominate. There will be diverse packages of ideas competing in the marketplace. And we've labored under the view for decades now that the more open and the more liberal our economy, the better we would do, and that open countries would best take advantage of globalization. Well, I'm not sure that that's actually been the case. Our middle classes have been suffering through stagnant wages for a couple of decades. The Chinese middle class is growing by leaps and bounds, and one of the main reasons is because of globalization. Billions of low-wage workers have entered the global economy, and a lot of the jobs they've taken have come from the United States. And I'd also say that in a world in which huge amounts of capital flow around the globe on a daily basis, it has advantages to have a tighter hand on the tiller. And in that respect, Ian, I think that you're right, that the United States needs to take a page from countries like Germany or like China that have more state involvement and that think strategically about their long-term economic future, because we've let the market take its course for the last few decades, and it hasn't led to the kinds of results that we would like.
Again, I'm speaking with Charles Kupchan, Professor of International Affairs at Georgetown University and a senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations. He was the Director of European Affairs on the National Security Council during the Clinton administration and is the author of the new book, No One's World, The West, The Rising Rest, and The Coming Global Turn. But it does seem in many ways, Charles Kupchan, that we are already in Adam Smith's world of where capital transcends sovereignty. In Sunday's New York Times, there's an article on the rich Chinese coming over and shopping at the best New York stores for luxury goods. There seems to be an emerging global elite, not to mention the elite here in this country that has been identified by the Occupy movement, the 99% versus the 1%. How much is that a global phenomenon? You mentioned the distressed middle class. It may be emerging in China, but also enormous amount of corruption at the top and enormous and I believe the distribution of wealth in China is even worse than it is here.
Well, you know, globalization is increasing inequality both within countries like it is in the United States and between countries. The countries at the front of the pack are going growing very quickly, and others are falling behind. And I think that one of the issues that we face today is how to create a tamer brand of globalization, how to make sure that the benefits of a globalized world are spread more evenly. And that is now front and center in our political discourse, because Obama is running on a platform of what I would call progressive populism. You know, let's get an economy that works not just for the 1%, but also for the 99%. It's an uphill battle. Our country is balkanized and polarized, but I think we are finally beginning to have a debate about how America can be competitive in a globalized world. I'm not someone who believes in American decline. I think this is an enormously resilient country, but we haven't figured out how to recraft things, how to be competitive. And that's going to take, I think, a level of shrewdness and strategic planning that will be unprecedented for the United States.
So in your new book, No One's World, Charles Kupchan, you suggest that China and other rising powers will not follow the Western or the U.S. path of development. In terms of China, though, it seems to me that there's an internal struggle that's going on there, and that to some extent it's come to light with this new scandal with the Politburo guy that was fired. Mm-hmm. He was immensely wealthy, immensely corrupt, but apparently the corruption is totally pervasive. And you have this country that has a nascent government structure, but it's overruled by the kind of Communist Party mafia. So are these inevitable projections of China, often being argued as the next hegemon, I've always been a little skeptical of them. It seems to me that China, to the rest of the world may see China as a rising power, but I think the Chinese leaders are always looking over their shoulder at what's going on inside the country.
I think it's easy to exaggerate China's rise and to assume that we're going to wake up tomorrow morning and everyone's going to be speaking Mandarin. That's not going to happen. And what I've tried to do in the book, though, is to push back against the dominant view that everyone is heading in our direction. And you're right to say that China will have problems in the years ahead, but it's following a different path of development. Our middle classes led our rise, beginning with the Reformation. China's middle class has been co-opted into the state. Many of them have become party members. At least for now, the middle class defends the status quo. It may be that China does democratize eventually, but it's going to take generations. And then when I look at the Middle East, for example, people say, aha, the Arab Spring, the Middle East is breaking America's way. Well, the kind of democracy that we're getting there doesn't look anything like our democracy. And that's because mosque and state are not separated in most of the Muslim world, and political Islam is the beneficiary. So I don't believe that any of these models, political Islam, the state capitalism, China, are going to take the world by storm. But I do think that it means that we're headed into a world that for the first time in history will be globalized and interdependent, but without a dominant political model or center of gravity.
So, Charles Kupchan, would you therefore predict that political Islam will be the beneficiary of the Arab Spring? I mean, will it survive in Iran or strengthen Iran? It seems to be pretty much the result of the revolution in Egypt has been to bring about the Muslim Brotherhood, although the candidates are just disqualified by the presidency. Well, they clearly will control the parliament, though.
Yeah, I think that the Middle East has had many secular regimes in its past, but they've been secular by coercion. And what's happening now is that participatory politics is spreading, and the regimes that emerge have more popular legitimacy, but most of the people in these countries want more religion and politics. Two-thirds of the Egyptian public wants civil law to follow the Quran. That means to me that we'll see Islamist parties dominate in most of the countries of the region as democracy moves forward, and then we will see, are they able to retain popularity when they face the hard task of governing? The answer is, well, in some cases, yes, in some cases, no. But I do think that the United States, which has long backed secular parties across the Middle East, is now going to have to think long and hard about building partnerships with parties like the Muslim Brotherhood, because they are really going to be the ones that are calling the shots in most countries in the Middle East.
And, of course, that raises great anxiety in Israel. But it would seem to me that in terms of Islam we already have an example, for example, of Saudi Arabia, which is an immensely wealthy country, but it has a very, very austere version of Islam. And it seems to me that in spite of the enormous wealth that they have, that as long as you basically discount or imprison even a half of your population, you're never going to find a path to modernity. You're saying that Islam can find a political Islam can find a path to modernity. It's surely not going to be the Saudi model.
No, and that's why I think the United States should be looking at how to encourage centrist brands of political Islam, more along the Turkish model, where modernization and democratization combine with Islamic values to create states that are upwardly mobile with good education systems and that play in the global economy. And we just don't know where this is heading right now. If you look at Egypt, for example, there are some Salafists and other extreme brands of Islamists, and there are others who are much more in the center. And I think the best that we can hope for as the process moves forward is to strengthen those that are in the center of political Islam. And I'm not someone who believes that we should see this as negative. I think it's different. There is a different view of religion and politics in the Middle East than there is in the West post-Reformation. And it's simply part of adjusting to a world in which these different kinds of political models are in the ascendant.
Well, just in closing, Charles Kupchan, in terms of our policymakers and our pundits, as I mentioned in the opening, they are basically not only resisting or don't want to contemplate these changes, they don't appear to want to prepare for them. And what's your sense of our intellectual Praetorian Guard in Washington, D.C., in as much as they're listened to by our political leaders. Mm-hmm. What would you have a consensus there of whether we're past the jingoism and moving on to reality?
Well, you know, I think we've passed through one important turning point in the last decade, and that is 10 years ago, everybody was pronouncing American primacy was here to stay. It would last until the end of time. In 2012, after the financial crisis, the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, the rise of China, I think people here get it. People here understand that we're moving into a period in history in which the pendulum is swinging away from the West to other parts of the world. Where I don't think the debate has advanced is figuring out what that means, what it means for how the world will work. And there, I think, there is still a conviction that even if Western primacy erodes, the Western order that we have built will survive. The Chinese, the Indians, Brazilians, the Turks, they are going to dock in our harbor. And there, I think, is where the real intellectual and political work needs to be done, because as I've said, I don't think that that's how things are going to play out over the next few decades.
Well, thank you so much for joining us here today, Charles Kupchan.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you.
Again, Charles Kupchan is a professor of international affairs at Georgetown University and a senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations. He was a director of European affairs on the National Security Council during the Clinton administration, and before that worked on the U.S. State Department, at the U.S. State Department in the policy planning staff. He's the author of the new book, No One's World, The West, The Rising East, and The Coming Global Turn. We're going to take a brief station break and be back talking with the nation's leading authority on taxes and who pays them, and he has a shocking story to tell us.
The line it is drawn, the curse it is cast. The slow one now will later be fast, as the present now will later be past. The order is rapidly fading, and the first one now will later be last, for the times they are a-changing.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. And joining us now is David K. Johnston, a Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative reporter, formerly with The New York Times. He teaches at the Syracuse University College of Law and writes columns for tax analysts and Reuters, and has uncovered so many tax dodges that he's been called the de facto chief tax enforcement officer of the United States. He is the author of the best-selling books Perfectly Legal, Free Lunch, and his most recent is The Fine Print, How Big Companies Use Plain English to Rob You Blind. He has an article at Reuters, Taxed by the Boss. Welcome to Background Briefing, David K. Johnston.
Thank you, Ian.
And welcome, and happy tax day, David, even though, of course, the IRS have given, tax day is falling today on a Sunday, they've given a couple of extra days, so the taxes aren't due until Tuesday. But
right, in Massachusetts, it's a holiday, so on Monday, so you have till Tuesday.
So, your article in Reuters, Taxed by the Boss, is just breathtaking. It really does. I thought we were an advanced democracy here in the United States. I didn't realize that feudalism existed in America. But when I read your article, that it reveals that 2,700 of the biggest corporations like GE, GM, Goldman Sachs, Procter & Gamble are collecting state income taxes from hundreds of thousands of workers and pocketing them with the state's approval. People aren't getting tax refunds. They're getting their tax monies instead of it going to the state government, it's going to their employers.
A number of people have posted at my column, as well as other websites, that they find it hard to believe you can do this, but it is going on in 16 states, and my prediction is it will spread to more states unless people stand up and stop. and demand that it stop. And it's part of the reason that state governments, which are the most crucial to our lives because they finance the things that matter in people's lives every day, education, public health, a lot of law enforcement, state governments are all in terrible straits. And part of the reason is the biggest corporations have been exempted from a lot of the corporate income tax. So most of the corporate income tax at the state level comes from entrepreneurial, family-owned businesses, not from the big national, multinational corporations. Then they give these big companies property tax breaks. Oh, build a factory, an office building, and we won't charge any property taxes for a long time. They give them sales tax breaks. Oh, well, we're not going to charge you sales tax if you put up a new building and put all the furniture in it. And they've run out of ways to feed them money, so they've said, well, tell you what, why don't you take all the state income taxes deducted from your workers' paychecks, and we'll give you a tax credit equal to that. In essence, we'll let you pocket the state income taxes paid by your workers. And so far, it looks to be about $5.5 billion has been siphoned off this way.
So this is this model, I guess, sounds to me similar to what happens with cities who try and invite NFL teams in and offer all kind of concessions. And we all know that the owners of these NFL teams are all billionaires by and large, and they don't need the money. And most of these cities end up, losing money wholesale. So this is that the same mentality that's writ at a state level?
Yes, and one of the things, Ian, I've been trying for years and years to get people to understand is that, well, you will hear all this rhetoric about, oh, poor people, you know, and how they're getting these people who don't work and whatnot. The reality is that we have a massive socialist redistribution scheme upward and what I call corporate socialism. We take from the many to give to the already rich few. Now, everybody who's rich doesn't get these deals. These deals go to big corporations with clout. And what's particularly fascinating about this particular deal, I wrote about this last July when I found out it was going on in Illinois, and a group called Good Jobs First, which specializes in identifying corporate subsidies. And they're not against subsidies per se, but they're against secrecy and stupidity and waste and abuse in them. They worked on this project for a long time to come up with all of these records and the numbers that they have, 2,700 companies, $5.5 billion so far, are actually lowball because many of the states who have various programs hide things or they make minimal disclosures because they say, well, it's proprietary information. It doesn't matter that your tax dollars. It's the secret of the company. We have to maintain that first and foremost. And this kind of programming is just emblematic of this entire movement in America to subsidize these giant corporations. And the biggest beneficiaries of this are foreign corporations. Nissan is the single biggest beneficiary. They don't even have in their study some other companies, I believe, have very, very similar deals, but they're not technically done the way this one is, including a big German steelmaker. Every one of the big Canadian, Japanese, and European banks with U.S. operations has deals like this, and they're in the database of companies that are doing this. So people are having their schools for their children or their grandchildren shortchanged to benefit the owners of banks in Japan and Luxembourg. I mean, this is crazy.
Right, the libraries are closing. They've hoisted this canard, the Republicans have, that state workers are overpaid and overpensioned, etc. And meanwhile, the real socialism is going to these huge corporations. But in your article at Reuters, Taxed by the Boss, David K. Johnston, you refer to this as job blackmail.
Yes. Well, there are two things. There's job blackmail and there's job piracy. Job blackmail is when a company says, we're going to close our plant and move unless you give us money. In Illinois, they've passed a law that says in order to qualify to keep your workers' state income taxes, you have to threaten to leave the state. So Motorola, which Google is in the process of buying, said, we're going to leave. Well, now think about that. They have all these highly paid technical workers whose average income is over $100,000 a year. They're going to uproot them all, have them leave Chicago with all of its cultural facilities and go to Iowa. I don't think the workers will follow them. Navistar, oh, we're going to move to Alabama. I don't think that's going to happen. Ford said, we're going to shut down our factory and we'll move it across the state line over to Indiana. And so they gave them these deals. That's job blackmail. Give us money or we'll move our jobs. GE got this deal for in Ohio, and for investing $126 million, they get $115 million back. So their shareholders are bearing 8% of the cost of fixing up their old factory, and taxpayers are bearing 92% of the cost. No wonder GE is a profitable company. The other practice is called job piracy, and that's where you just steal jobs from the state. So your state will have more jobs, but America has no more jobs. And the AMC theater chain, you know, those big multiplexes that AMC has, they are moving their corporate headquarters from downtown Kansas City, Missouri, across the Missouri River to Leawood, a suburb in the state of Kansas. They're getting $47 million for doing this. Doesn't create a single job.
Well, it's worth noting, as you do in your article, David K. Johnston, that AMC Entertainment is owned by these Wall Street firms, J.P. Morgan, Apollo Management, and, here we go, Bain Capital.
Mitt Romney's company, and
the Carlyle Group. We could spend an hour talking about the Carlyle Group.
And Apollo Management, people should know, that's run by Leon Black. And who is Leon Black? He was Michael Milken's right-hand guy. I mean, he was right in there with him during the whole junk bond era.
Right, as is Peter Ackerman, who's running Americans Elect. I'm actually going to be talking with their representatives. They're running candidates in this election. So, let's talk a little bit then. David K. Johnston, a Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative reporter, formerly with the New York Times. His latest book is Plain English. How Governments Use Plain English to Rob You Blind. And he has an article at Reuters, Taxed by the Boss. Here we have the Republican nominee from Bain Capital, Mitt Romney, who just said that he's going to get an extension on his taxes. He was forced to reveal that he pays less than 15% in taxes. President Obama, on the other hand, said that he pays over 20%, but he still pays less than his secretary, and he's pushing the Buffett rule that's not going to really make much difference in terms of tax revenues coming into the Treasury, but it's a good political weapon that he has.
Oh, Ian, actually, Ian, it really is a lot of money.
It is?
Yeah. I mean, it's not enough to close the massive budget shortfalls we have, but we're talking about, you know, billions and billions of dollars. You know, the reason, part of the core problem we have in America is that we've listened to this talk about tax cut, and we're starving the public sector. And the problem is that all private wealth creation depends on public spending. It depends on education. It depends on civil justice. It depends on roads and water mains and other things. And we're destroying all of that, and in the short run, it's making a small group of people wealthier, but in the long run, it's impoverishing the entire country.
Well, that is the debate I wish we had. I mean, I'm astounded at the economic illiteracy and the gullibility of so many Americans, particularly working Americans who vote Republican and will vote for people like Paul Ryan. In his proposals, are going to take away their Social Security and their Medicare in order to give further tax breaks to the rich, which are extraordinary. And people fall for this argument right across the political spectrum that we're taxed too much. We're about the lowest taxed country in the world. The real argument should be, what do we get back in terms of government services? Let's focus on that and then demand some value, because the way the system's been rigged now is that the federal treasury has become a piggy bank for the 1% and the powerful corporations.
Yes. Well, there are reasons for this, though. My brother, Ian, who is disabled now and lives in Oregon, spent most of his life as a manual laborer. I mean, he was the kind of guy who was out digging ditches and clearing culverts after a rainstorm so people could get to work instead of having the roads flooded out. And he observed to me one day, you know, if I cared about guns, if I hated gays, or if I believed in God, then I would vote for the Republicans. I don't any of those things, but the question I have to ask is, what have the Democrats done for me? They strike me as just the soft Republicans. And I think that's an interesting insight from somebody who's not at all sophisticated. What have the Democrats done for ordinary Americans? The Republicans, at least, have appealed to those people who are homophobic, who are Second Amendment purists, and have other similar views, and they're appealing to them. That's why they're getting a lot of people to vote for them. It's not economic interest. They've gotten people off economic interest.
So why then are the Democrats afraid to defend government and to make a case for better government, for more responsive government? And I thought Americans were very practical people, bottom line people. They're getting hosed. They get so little back in terms for their taxes. A lot of it goes to agribusiness, to the military-industrial complex. The only programs that they get anything back from, Social Security, which is a separate fund, and Medicare, they're being cut out from under them. I mean, it's amazing. You take away a little bit of the social safety net in some of these European countries, and people take to the streets immediately.
Right, but remember that in America, we don't teach critical thinking skills. We don't have you question what's going on in the schools. You can have a better debate about economic and political and cultural matters with the average waiter you will meet in the countryside of Canada or France than the average MBA in the United States. And the Republicans have poured a fortune into ideological marketing. Ralph Nader came along in the 60s. He scared the hell out of corporate America, but some smart people in public relations and advertising looked at what Nader did and said, oh, we can do that. And then we got the Heritage Foundation. We got Cato, heavily funded by the Koch brothers, and in fact, actually turns out a nonprofit partly owned by them, and 10 other big, what I call ideological marketing organizations. They have spent years turning out slogans, advertising slogans, to get people to think the way they want. And remember that half of all Americans were 7 years old or younger when Ronald Reagan became president. So all that about two-thirds of Americans have ever known, that is everybody who was under the age of 20 when Reagan took office, is Reaganism. They have no idea how much better off people were back then. In my column in Reuters recently, I revealed that the average income of the bottom 90% of Americans has now fallen back to the level of 1966. Not 1996, 1966, when Lyndon Johnson was president, China was called red, and cars didn't have air conditioning.
Well, David, I thank you so much for joining us here today. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with David K. Johnston, a Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative reporter, formerly with The New York Times. He's the author of The Fine Print, How Big Companies Use Plain English to Rob You Blind. He has an article at Reuters, Taxed by the Boss. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another background briefing. Bye for now.
Standing along the side of the pickup truck, a shot rang out in the night, just when everything seemed right, another headline written down in America. The guy that lived next door in 305 took the kids to the park and disappeared by half.